Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Every time you talk about oil prices, somebody always mentions supply, as in there isn't enough of it. And what crude there is usually in places that are dangerous, unstable, or both. Shell made a deal today with militants in Nigeria, but the markets, well, they barely noticed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 5th of April today, Thursday. Glad to have you here. Nigeria is the biggest oil exporter in Africa. It's part of OPEC. And for the past year, violence in the Niger River Delta has meant crude production there has been cut to a relative trickle. Not good news for a world that uses crude by the millions of barrels a day. Royal Dutch Shell, in particular, has had its output cut in half. So you'd think the company's agreement today to safely resume full production would be cause for celebration on the commodities markets. And prices did edge down a little, but in the grand scheme of things, the dime that crude dropped really doesn't amount to much. Marketplace's Bob Moon spent the day trying to figure out why.
When I called a leading oil trader in New York today to ask about the significance of Shell's new agreement, his lack of response was telling. He said he hadn't really read past the headline. And it seemed most oil traders weren't paying much attention. Alex Gorbansky makes it his business to follow the oil business in Africa for Frontier Strategy Group. He says the deal has the potential to improve the flow of oil from Nigeria, but he's only cautiously optimistic.
Yes, it's a step in the right direction for Shell. However, I would expect that at least in the short term, you're going to continue to see interruptions in production and similar types of security challenges that we've seen in the past.
Gorbansky is concerned some of the more militant groups apparently aren't a party to the deal. Shell says it's agreed to significantly increase the amount of work it awards local communities in exchange for being allowed back into the western Niger Delta. But UCLA political science professor Edmund Keller says Shell can only do so much on its own.
It doesn't really satisfy the basic complaint that people in the Delta have, and that is too much of their oil revenue goes to other parts of the country, and they reap only about 13%.
Keller also points out national elections in Nigeria are less than 2 weeks away, and they could yet cause their own kind of turmoil.
It could very well be a disaster. You know, in worst-case scenario, there'll be another military coup, and we'll be back to square one where we were 10 years ago.
Not to mention, he says, that other oil companies are being pressured to come up with their own agreements, leaving Nigerian oil production as uncertain as it's ever been. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Crude's only one of the things lumped in the category we call commodities. Metals are stuck in there as well, and they're in the middle of quite a run. Nickel hit $50,000 a ton today. That's a record, up 50% since the start of the year. Copper and lead are going at three-month highs, too, but the dollar's not doing so well. It sank to a two-year low against the euro today. Beijing's been saying for a while now that too much economic growth isn't necessarily a good thing. The Chinese economy has been booming for years, annual increases in GDP growth above 10%. The government's doing all it can to slow things down. For the sixth time in less than a year, regulators have told banks they need to hang on to more of their reserves. That is, take money out of the market. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now from New York.
Chinese officials think the economy grew a whopping 11% in the first quarter. That's well above the government's goal of 8%. China worries unchecked growth could set off a crash like the one that hit Japan, Taiwan, and other Asian countries in the mid-1990s. Barry Eichengreen is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley. He doubts today's move will help. He says China's developing very fast, and there are many other ways of getting money to invest.
So the traditional device of instructing the banks not to lend or requiring them to hold more cash as reserves simply will no longer work.
China's tried other tactics to cool off the economy. Last month, it raised interest rates to the highest level in 8 years. And it's also tried to prohibit lending to certain sectors, such as construction. William Overholt heads the RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. He says China still has one more trick it could try.
The other thing they could do is float their currency. And that would have a lot more impact, but they're still worried about the effect that will have on the banks and on some of their weaker exporters.
Overholt says China's not the only one who should be worried about its hyperactive economy. If it were to crash, he says, the impact would be felt around the world. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday about some of the private equity firms circling Chrysler. As of this afternoon, there's another potential buyer in the mix, one that has a long history with Detroit. Investor Kirk Kerkorian's company, Tresinda, says it's offered $4.5 billion to buy the struggling car maker from Daimler Chrysler. Kerkorian, you might remember, tried to buy Chrysler about 12 years ago. He failed, and then he sued Daimler Chrysler after the companies merged back in 1998. Kerkorian also had a big stake in General Motors last year and tried to broker an alliance with Nissan and Renault. When that deal fell through, he sold off his GM shares. One point to note, the offer for Chrysler is contingent on the carmaker coming to a favorable labor deal with the United Auto Workers Union. Fans of the five-finger discount know all about avoiding in-store detectives and hidden cameras, but retailers and police will soon have a new tool to fight shoplifting. A national internet database launches on Monday. Two leading trade groups are collaborating to fight organized retail crime, things like shoplifting, burglaries, and counterfeiting. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Organized retail crime significantly eats away at the bottom line. Joseph LaRocca is with the National Retail Federation, one of the trade groups championing the new database.
Retailers in 2005 lost $37.5 billion nationwide, about 1.5% of their inventory, which ultimately you and I pay for as consumers. We pay more at the register, and it's almost like a hidden crime tax.
He says about 2 cents out of every retail dollar you spend goes to offset the cost of crime.
This isn't little Johnny taking a pack of bubble gum. These are very organized, very sophisticated groups that are targeting retailers.
How does organized shoplifting work? I asked Tim O'Connor with the trade group and co-sponsor, the Retail Industry Leaders Association. He says thieves move quickly along geographic corridors, then
take the product back to the home base and fence it, whether online or through a fence operation that they run. They used to get 10, 20 cents on the dollar. Now they can get 50, 60 cents on the dollar because they run their own organization.
Of course, computers and electronics are popular, but O'Connor says they'll steal everything from lingerie and socks to
the ready-to-serve baby formula. There's a lot of dollars in that.
That stolen, unrefrigerated baby formula may spoil before it's sold over the internet. The new database will help retailers defend against criminal trends, and it will also help law enforcement identify patterns. A year's subscription to the database will cost around $1,200. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
This is the end of the working week for stock traders. Equities markets will be closed for Good Friday, so investors had to do some preemptive buying and selling to line things up for tomorrow. That's when the March unemployment report comes out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yahoo unveiled a new website today. It's a shopping site of sorts, kind of depressing, though. It'll let you search for foreclosed properties. It'll probably be pretty successful. There's been a rise in foreclosures since the subprime mortgage market hit the skids. But expensive lending, like subprimes, extends beyond just mortgages. Credit cards, auto loans, and fast cash places are all in the same category. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli looks at the wider consequences of high-priced credit.
Of all the places where you might learn about subprime lending, maybe one of the last you'd think of is a school's geography department. But Professor Steve Graves at Cal State Northridge has taken to mapping three types of subprime lending. He says mapping lenders' locations tells them a lot more than their addresses.
It lays bare the business model for this industry.
Graves says that model targets poor neighborhoods, including places you might not think of, like the streets around military bases. But here's where the subprime story departs from the expected. This time, poor people aren't the only ones deeply involved. What other groups might be hard hit?
I have suspect categories.
Ada Foser is a former Massachusetts banking commissioner who's written extensively about lending. She hasn't fully researched this yet, but says she's picking up a set of wealthier communities that may also be subprime misery zones.
I would be looking to communities that have concentrations of software, computer programmer people, where their negotiating power in the marketplace has gone down. I'd be looking for communities that have young families.
In other words, folks caught in the middle class squeeze of stagnant wages and rising costs for housing, health care, and education. Subprime lenders say they exist for these people and lower income folks. Jamie Fulmer of Advance America, a 2,800-store payday lender, describes his firm's fast cash loans much as other subprime lenders describe their products.
We think that this is a product that consumers value, this is a product that consumers like, and this is a product that they have overwhelmingly demonstrated that they use responsibly.
Fulmer says most borrowers don't have better options, a claim that's hotly contested, and that most are smart enough to go elsewhere if there are less expensive deals. Subprime lenders say they're democratizing credit, giving folks who would never have gotten a loan under old standards a chance at a better life. Those arguments drive opponents like Kathleen Keast crazy.
I think it's more like an anvil around people's neck than a helping hand up.
Keast works for the nonpartisan Center for Responsible Lending. She and others point to numerous studies saying many subprime borrowers can do better but don't know it, in part because they're misled by loan marketers. These critics say millions become hopelessly mired in subprime debt before they realize what's hit them. Their arguments have new support. The Federal Comptroller of the Currency's office now says abusive lending and fraud is feeding subprime mortgage defaults. So what might come next? The streets of Boston's working-class Dorchester neighborhood have seen this story before. Cycles of high-cost lending in communities like this one have been tremendous wealth destroyers. Ada Foser, the former state banking commissioner, lived here for 30 years. When the downward cycle starts and people start losing their homes, she says no one in these communities gets away unscathed.
Everybody who lives there, even the people who are not being foreclosed on, lose wealth.
Empty homes sink real estate values. People flee. Even many who survive their loans see precious years of equity building wiped out. Half a continent away, legal services lawyer Diane Thompson also sees this around East St. Louis, Illinois.
We are looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars being sucked out of a community that could desperately use that money to build wealth, to fix the roads, to send the kids to better schools. And instead, that money is just disappearing in exorbitant credit rates.
In the past month, news reports have detailed major stress and mortgage foreclosures in suburbs of Cleveland, Atlanta, and Chicago. Pockets near Sacramento are staggering. Boston's far suburbs make up half of the nation's top 10 spots for subprime mortgage delinquencies. The way things reached this point is also different this time. Subprime lenders and those who package their financing for investors often make their money up front now. Researcher Alan White says that's a big change from the days when lenders held their own loans and absorbed all the damage if things went bad.
There's no feedback cycle. The harm and the pain caused by foreclosures and bankruptcies is not necessarily going to make its way back to the lending markets.
No one knows how bad this will get, but we already know one thing for sure and one that's likely. We know there will be many pockets of concentrated pain, not all of them poor. And what's likely is that the argument over how this happened and what, if anything, needs to be done about subprime lending is about to get hotter. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
If the subprime collapse has hit you or somebody you know, tell us about it. Our website is marketplace.org. Pepsi wants better-looking cans, and so it unveiled the design contest yesterday. $10,000 and you're drawing on 500 million of those cans if you win. The soda company is trying to push back against healthier consumers. They're choosing fancy bottled water or other drinks over Pepsi's brand-name product. Commentator Benjamin Barber says water in convenient packaging might be nice to have, but it's a symptom of capitalism gone bad.
Capitalism used to be the perfect recipe for joining self-interest to altruism. Produce a good to answer real human needs, and the world becomes a better place while you make a profit. But today, in the developed world, a great many core wants and needs have already been met. So capitalism is busy manufacturing needs to sell all the goods it produces to people who don't really need the stuff until the marketers persuade them they do. Bottled water is a classic example. It creates a phony need among the well-heeled for the same H2O they can get from their taps, to the tune of $10 billion in sales a year. But it doesn't address the real need for clean water among the world's 3 billion water needy. Take Starbucks Ethos Bottled Water. The company recently organized marches around World Water Day to raise awareness of the global water crisis. Who wouldn't applaud those efforts? But Ethos Water just contributes to global inequality. It doesn't solve it. Ethos pretends to address global needs by promising to send 5 cents on every $2 unnecessary bottle of water sold. That's a drop in the bucket. You want to help meet real third world needs? Then stop buying bottled water altogether. And every time you drink a glass of tap water, send the whole $2 you just saved to UNICEF or Mercy Corps. Or better yet, if you're an entrepreneur, figure out how you can help Africans manufacture small pumps that tap clean groundwater, or water filters from the clay under their feet. You'll be serving humanity and making money. Millions who live in poverty do potentially have real collective earning power. I bet they pay a few cents to buy those filters. That would get us back to the way capitalism is supposed to work, by producing goods that meet real needs.
Benjamin Barber's latest book is called Consumed. We need you to send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Coming up, the next diet craze may be no diet at all.
You're always looking for what's the thing that has captured America's attention. And with 300 million eaters, it doesn't take much for something to catch fire.
But first, let's do the numbers. 6 straight days of gains have the Dow just below where it was in late February. The Dow Industrials gained 30 points today, 0.2%, to close at 12,560. The Nasdaq climbed 12 points, 0.5%, to close at 2,471. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.3%, to finish at 1,443. For the trading week that was, the Dow up 0.7%, the Nasdaq up 2.3%, the S&P 500 jumped up 1.8%. Daimler Chrysler stock rose 5% today in the wake of that offer from Kurt Kerkorian we told you about. General Motors, too, caught a tailwind. Its stock rose 2.8%. Analysts had some happy talk for future earnings about tech stocks. Yahoo rose 1%. Microsoft ticked up 0.1%. Web Methods rocketed 27% on news that Germany's Software AG had offered about $500 million in cash to buy it. Overseas, Tokyo's Nikkei fell 0.3%. The FTSE in London rose about 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases unemployment numbers for March. The Commerce Department reports on consumer credit for February. And a major report on the impact of global warming is scheduled for release. Scientists and diplomats in Brussels are debating scenarios to alter what could be the devastating course of rising temperatures around the world. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Sopranos' long goodbye begins for real Sunday night. Technically, the 9 episodes we're about to get are the tail end of Season 6. The first part aired last spring, and you can't really blame HBO for stretching things out. By some estimates, it's the most profitable network in television, netting $1 billion a year, thanks in large part to The Sopranos. So we thought it might be opportune to look at what the network's going to do now that Tony and the gang are going. Aaron Barnhart is the TV critic at the Kansas City Star. Aaron, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So HBO has been at the center of a happy confluence of events for a number of years. They had Sex and the City, they had 6 Feet Under, they had, of course, The Sopranos. What is HBO going to do now that The Sopranos is gone?
Well, they still got a ton of original programming on HBO. You bear in mind, this was the network that won 5 Peabody Awards this week, more than any other network. And not one of them was for The Sopranos. They put on a high-quality film almost every single month with some of the top acting talent in the world. They've got a couple of very promising programs coming up very soon. There's a show called John from Cincinnati, which was created by David Milch, whom HBO fans know as the creator of Deadwood, another very successful show for them during this time. And then Alan Ball, who created 6 Feet Under, has got some sort of a vampire drama, so that will be coming online pretty soon. Of course, this fall is the final season of The Wire, which, if I can put on my TV critic's hat for a minute here, is a better program than The Sopranos and is arguably the greatest achievement of any television network ever. As for the buzz, you know, are they going to get that with the finale of The Wire? Probably not.
All right, but that buzz helped them get, last number I saw was 30 million subscribers. How many people are going to stick around when the buzz is gone?
Well, HBO's got a lot riding on their video on demand service for that very reason. There's this whole inventory that HBO has now accumulated, not only The Sopranos, The Wire, Sex and the City, Oz. All these things are sitting right there on video on demand. And what they're arguing is, what would you rather do, spend $80 to watch these things on DVD or watch these fine quality programs anytime you want to?
Chris Albrecht, the guy who runs HBO, is obviously spinning this as sort of, it's not, you know, the beginning of the end, but really sort of the end of the beginning. Are you buying that HBO's got better days ahead of it?
We'll see. Some of it will depend on this video on demand. Some of it will depend on their program development. Here's one thing we know for sure, that the television market is a different one than it was when HBO first got in the game. That works, I think, in HBO's favor and somewhat against it. It works in HBO's favor in that creatives now no longer go to the top 4 networks anymore necessarily with their ideas. I have a writer friend. He's developing a treatment right now for HBO. He never had any other network in mind besides HBO for doing that. That is a definite psychological shift in the creative community in the 8 years since The Sopranos has been on. However, it's also benefited the whole television market in that you've seen networks like FX, which a lot of people say is the basic cable version of HBO. You've seen CBS and Fox and NBC and ABC really push the standards of what you can put on primetime TV. So there's a lot more competition for those quality writers, directors, and producers. And HBO doesn't have the field to itself quite as much as it did just a few years ago.
All right, Aaron, thanks a lot. Aaron Barnhart is a television critic for the Kansas City Star. He also runs the website TVBarn.com. Aaron, we'll talk to you later.
My pleasure.
Summer's coming, which means bathing suits, which means diets, and boom times for diet companies. More than half of us say we want to lose a significant amount of weight. The food industry has long cashed in on that desire. We've had the brand push, the non-fat craze, and of course, no carbs. Forget flex points. This year, the big dieting fad might be not eating at all. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith gave it a try.
I'm preparing my dinner for the evening. It's a drink made from lemon juice, maple syrup, and cayenne pepper flakes. It's called the Master Cleanse. It's supposed to be a way to flush out toxins, but it's become a diet craze. Much of the reason is Beyoncé Knowles. She told the press she'd lost 20 pounds in 2 weeks by, well, replacing food with the lemon juice concoction. Now that you're out of my life, I'm so much better. You thought that I'd be weak without you, but I'm stronger. The fast was invented back in the 70s, but now it's retro chic.
This is more a cultural phenomenon. You know, we're always looking for the next thing that's going to make us thin again, right?
That's nutritionist Oz Garcia. He says fasting can help cleanse the body of toxins, but that fast weight loss means fast weight gain. Okay, we know this, so why do we keep trying the next big crash diet? Garcia says our commercial culture is designed to make us fall prey to the halcyon promises of weight loss products. That's why we keep returning to slight variations of the same diet, like Atkins, South Beach, and Zone.
There's really not a lot of really good original thinking going on within the public. It's being done by institutions or individuals that actually get a little piece of good information about eating. They write a book about it, and people in their desperate desire to be thin grab onto it.
That grab can have a far reach. Atkins bulked dieting up to a $40 billion a year industry. Harry Balzer is with the NPD Group. It tracks Americans' eating habits. He says Atkins was a wake-up call for the food industry.
We had a number of companies approach us saying, would you just keep tabs on what diets Americans are interested in, what they're following, and which ones are growing, so that we're not caught like we were with Atkins.
Some niche companies are already profiting from the fasting fad. The Madal Ball syrup Beyoncé used has seen sales surge nearly 500%, and it's estimated sales of herbal cleansing products are approaching $30 million a year in the U.S. Balzer says it's too soon to tell whether fasting will get big enough to attract the attention of the conglomerates, but he says even a niche market in the diet business can generate a lot of moolah.
You're always looking for what's the thing that has captured America's attention. And with 300 million eaters, it doesn't take much for something to catch fire.
I held out on the fast for 3 days and lost 3 pounds. I wasn't hungry, but I was cranky, sluggish, and lightheaded. Fasting may do wonders for some, but I think I'll stick to meat and potatoes. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I gotta tell you, she might have lost a couple of pounds, but she really was not nice to be around.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. Mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE or TRowePrice.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, we woke up Monday morning to find out Chicago real estate investor Sam Zell was going to buy the Tribune Company in an $8 billion deal. Zell beat out a couple of Los Angeles billionaires to buy the publisher of the LA Times and some other newspapers. David Geffen, the movie mogul, had unsuccessfully offered $2 billion for the Times alone. Well, this morning we learned he might get the paper after all. The Washington Post reports Zell might sell the Times to Geffen or at least create some kind of joint venture deal with him. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 30 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ picked up 12 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That is 0.3%. Don't forget, the markets are closed tomorrow. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koble, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, black work culture and the forces that shaped it.
Low-skilled black males, that is, individuals with less than a high school education, spend only around 50% of their time working.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.